Hello, welcome back. I'm Celia.
And I'm Deanna.
And this is Carry the One Radio, a group of nerds who love to collaborate as a team to communicate collectively.
I feel like you're trying to hint at something.
Oh yeah, not subtle at all. I'm just really pumped because we met two scientists who are going to tell us all about groups, how we interact with each other, how our actions influence others, and how collectives end up being greater than the sum of their parts.
Okay, that's a lot. Let's collectively dive right in.
This is Carry the One.
Carry the One Radio, the science podcast.
Igniting scientific curiosity.
From the University of California,
San Francisco.
So, like I mentioned up top, we met two scientists who study the collective behavior of basically everything.
Between the two of them, I think they've studied over 70 animals, including humans and robots.
We'll let them introduce themselves.
My name's Ian Cousin, he, him. I'm director of the Max Planck Institute of Animal Behavior in Konstanz, Germany.
I'm Naomi Eric Leonard, and I am professor of mechanical and aerospace engineering at Princeton University.
We didn't know it when we first reached out to schedule these interviews, but it turns out the two of them go way back.
My collaborator, Ian Cousin.
I want to say that we're also interviewing them for this.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so I'm working with a collaborator who's going to interview them.
Oh, that's great. So he's, you know, ingenious.
He really is, but he credits others for it.
You know, we often think of ourselves as being, you know, we are smart, but we think of ourselves as being sort of autonomous and, you know, making smart decisions and sort of taking credit in a sense for good decisions we're making. Like, I did that because I'm smart or whatever. And I think in actual fact, in reality, you know, unbeknownst to us, we're actually very strongly influenced and very strongly influence other individuals subconsciously.
Before we keep going, kind of just want to make sure we're on the same page here. I mean, what exactly is collective behavior? It must have something to do with people behaving collectively, right? I mean, am I close?
Yeah, pretty close, actually. Ian explains more.
If we think about it in a very basic sense, again, if we think of ourselves, you know, I might be influencing you and you influencing me at the same time, but with different weights, with different emphasis. You know, you might be influencing me more than I'm influencing you. What about if there's a third person there? Are they influencing me directly or are they influencing me via their influence of you? What about if there's 10 people? What about if there's 100 people? What about if we have this interconnected social network on our planet? You know, then it's really hard and really interesting to try and understand how these different opinions all influence each other in this sort of network. So we now have multiple networks. We have networks where we verbally communicate. We have networks where we use things like telephones to communicate over longer distances. But we also have networks like Twitter and Facebook where we can communicate globally, near instantaneously with others. And humans have not evolved to do this. We have evolved in relatively small, tight-knit groups like family groups or groups of families and tribes, typically under 100 individuals. The communication is by, you know, verbal or writing or art, or song, relatively slow, whereas now I can instantaneously or near instantaneously send a message to someone at the opposite side of the globe, maybe someone that I don't even know. And so this fundamentally changes the types of properties that emerge when we think about collective behavior. So, and I think we can't understand ourselves without understanding how we behave within this collective.
Trippy. Okay, so we can't understand ourselves unless we understand all of ourselves.
I know I can sometimes feel my actions and personality shift when I move between different social settings. I can feel myself subconsciously trying to hone in on the current vibe, try to adapt to it.
Are you sure you're not just a Gemini?
No way. It is always Scorpio season over here. But back to Ian. I asked him to tell us a little more about the kinds of questions his research group is asking.
So you see many animals, like birds in flight, you see them in flocks. When you look at fish, you see fish swimming in groups. And this is very common in nature. And we, of course, as humans, live in our human societies. And so I'm fascinated by, why do we live in these groups? What are the benefits of group living? And what can we learn by studying organisms like ants that form these cooperative groups, or locusts that form these huge swarms in Africa that impact the livelihood of actually, you know, millions of people, to our own human societies? You know, what's driven us in our evolutionary history to form these aggregates and to solve problems together.
It turns out that asking these kinds of questions doesn't just help us better understand animal and human behavior. As Naomi explains, they can also help us build better robots.
I'm very interested in using teams of robots to make a difference, to do things that people can't do, right? That can help us. And there's lots of things, like especially going into dangerous and remote environments. So I've done a lot of work on environmental monitoring, especially in the deep ocean. But there's also other kinds of things that you can imagine, like, you know, search and rescue, these kinds of things.
But before we get to robots, let's try to understand what it means to engage in collective behavior. I mean, as the term suggests, it's clearly a group of something. It doesn't even have to be living. That's working together.
Like honeybees or ants, they live in these massive, highly organized colonies, and the behavior of the colony is greater than the sum of its parts. It's hard to tell what's going on by watching one lonely bee, but by watching the behavior of bees collectively, you can pick out all kinds of cool things. Nest building, nursing babies, hive defense, honey making.
Right. I mean, then the question becomes, who's calling the shots? I mean, who decides what to do and how to do it? Is it just one special member of the group, some kind of leader? Or is it, you know, everyone working together? Or is it nobody?
If we think about, like, what is the essence of this logic that explains how groups move, you know, there's something very fundamental about the fact that all of these groups are ones in which there isn't kind of a conductor or a choreographer actually imposing, organizing, telling everybody what to do. Instead, these collective behaviors, these group motions come about from a distributed group, a decentralized setting where individuals literally are only responding to who's nearby. So picture like these beautiful flocks of birds that you see, you know, these murmurations of starlings. You know, you can't imagine that a single bird can see more than just a few of them nearby. They don't know what, you know, the thousandth bird away from them is doing. And so there's this fundamental idea in collective behavior that an individual is constantly looking at and observing and measuring what's going on around it in its local environment, right? As much as it can see or smell or hear or feel. And responding, updating what it's doing. So in the case of a flock of birds, you know, you picture they're moving together. One of them senses, I don't know, a predator or something good to eat and makes a sharp turn, right? And if the rule is to constantly look at which way your neighbors are heading and adjust your heading direction so that you line up with your neighbors, then, you know, the ones that are keeping track of the one that turned will turn with it. And the ones that are keeping track of those that turned will turn with them. And you'll get this, and sometimes extremely fast, you know, domino effect where all the birds turn together.
Okay, so there is a rule book, just a really, really complicated one.
Yeah, these beautiful flocking behaviors are hyper-coordinated by a wildly complex cascade of rules. But the most important one, love thy neighbor.
Or at least pay attention to what your neighbors are doing.
Exactly. If you boil it down to that one rule and make sure everyone follows it to a T, then you can get these really cool flocking patterns that look almost choreographed.
You know what this reminds me of?
What?
Actual choreography. Human dancers are kind of like bird flocks, but it seems like they're doing way more than just looking around at each other. Ballet school seems hard.
Good news. Dr. Leonard studies human dancers too. So she just said that there doesn't need to be a leader calling shots. But in the case of dancers, there's usually someone or a team of people that decide what structure that dance will take.
The combination of compositional rules, but also their own artistic choices and how they respond. But in every case, they may be creating something beautiful, but they're also creating something that is kind of amazing in its ability to be responsive to changes in the environment and to be robust to uncertainty, disturbances.
Okay, I still have a question. We've already brought up multiple model organisms, right? Robots, birds, humans, and they're all so different. So how the heck can you take information about bird flocks or schools of fish or what do you call a group of robots?
The internet suggests the jury's still out, but some people are leaning towards swarm.
Oh man, okay. Or a swarm of robots. So how can you apply all of that to humans networking or fighting with each other on Twitter?
Yeah, it's a great question because many scientists, they tend to focus on one organism and sort of study that organism in depth. And that's a very valid and very important approach to conducting science. But when one is interested in general phenomena, you're forced to study these different organisms. And, you know, these different animals have had completely different evolutionary histories. And so I've always found it really important to look at the principles of collective behavior or principles of biological organization. And one example is that perhaps surprisingly, the way that social information is transmitted, so, you know, in a human, this could be, you know, talking to each other and changing each other's opinions. In non-human animal groups, this could be my change of behavior, such as, you know, being alert and then running away from a predator, gets transmitted to other individuals within the group. Well, it turns out despite these, you know, vast differences, the basic principle, the basic mechanism is conserved, whether you're looking at a group of fish or a group of humans. And that's really kind of fascinating. The way that behavior spreads, we call it a social contagion, tends to be very, very similar. And we wouldn't have discovered that if it hadn't been possible to study these different types of animals. So I think the last time I counted, I think we were working on at least 65, probably more different species, all sort of chosen for different reasons, all of them valid reasons, you know, whether it's just because the researcher is fascinated in this particular organism or because it provides an important piece to the puzzle.
These are some big questions, both philosophically and literally. Like, potentially stupid question, but how could someone possibly study large groups of animals in a lab? Do they just have a basement full of bird flocks somewhere?
You know, I was actually wondering the same thing.
I have a big tank, and I have robots that swim around, and so I can try things there before I take them to the ocean. So we've also done things in the ocean. But in my lab, we can explore things. I have robots that move around on the ground, and so we can try all kinds of things, and we can create signals with light and all kinds of ways to create different kinds of environments to measure one another. But I also do work with biologists.
Like Ian.
So he's ingenious. Together we can come up with an idea and he can come up with a way to train. I mean, you know, you can train fish, you can run these kinds of experiments to try to extract insight. It's hard. It's not like telling people to follow these rules and do this, right? You have to come up with ways to sort of manipulate, to try to back out what you think might be going on. You know, you want to have a hypothesis and do what you can do with an experiment. And it's really been, you know, very exciting, you know, because we're going back and forth between the theory and the experiment. In the context with dancers, you know, the studio is really, in a sense, an experimental testbed. And there's kind of, I think of it as like, between, you know, sort of the best of both worlds in some sense, because we're working with humans who are making decisions and can articulate them, but they're not telling us everything that every neuron is doing in their brain, right? But we can also impose some design. We can give them constraints and rules and explore what happens and then go back and refine our models to understand if what we've tried is consistent.
But what are these constraints? What are these unifying principles to collective behavior that make studying bird flocks and bee swarms, the birds and the bees, so to speak?
Yikes, Deanna.
Okay, just let me live, please. Thank you. Okay, but my question really is, what underlying principles make studying these animal behaviors useful for understanding human collective behavior? I mean, are these the same, or can we translate one to the other?
I want to know, too. How does understanding robot swimming help us understand something like political decisions?
Naomi explained.
So what we do is try to understand what rules might be allowing for that incredible behavior. So it's not just that they move together. Like, we really need them to be able to exhibit the kind of behaviors that these rules have to explain, the kind of behaviors that lead to this remarkable behavior. And to understand that, you need to first understand, you know, what are the tensions, right? There are trade-offs. For example, being really robust to disturbance is somehow in tension with being responsive to changes in the environment. If you're too responsive, you're going to respond to everything. And if you reject everything as just a disturbance, then you'll miss something important, like, you know, the predator's moved over there, or the food is now coming from a different direction. So it's sorting out what are the key tensions, what are the key competing objectives that these groups have to manage, and how that translates back into roles that allow a group to do that. For example, you know, one of the key tensions that is really ubiquitous is referred to as the explore versus exploit tension, where exploit refers to focus on the well-known, whereas explore means to check out what you haven't, you know, what you don't know, check out the unknown.
Explore, exploit. It's like when you're trying to decide where to eat. I could exploit an option I already know that I like and order a black bean crunch wrap with a dragon fruit freeze from Taco Bell.
Weirdly specific, but okay.
Look, I know what I like and I exploit it, okay? But I could also choose to explore and try somewhere new and maybe find a new favorite. Our brains constantly weigh the pros and cons of these decision-making strategies. And this is super interesting, but I am still itching to know more about how these robots actually work. What do they look like? How do they move?
Okay, let's talk for a second about these robots.
I mean, I can tell you a little bit about this project that we did. We did several of them, and this was a big collaboration with oceanographers and ecologists to design strategies for these ocean-going robots. The particular kind of robot is called an underwater glider. They're these graceful vehicles that don't have propellers. They just glide down. But you can make them then buoyant and they glide up. And you can even move weight around so that they can, you know, they can pitch down, glide down, pitch up, glide up, or they could, you know, roll and turn. You can do spirals. You can do all kinds of things.
Well, that sounds like fun. I feel like there's probably a good reason they're out there, and it's not to do loop-de-loops.
They're used essentially as sensor platforms for measuring physical variables like temperature and salinity and currents. They could also measure concentration of phytoplankton or zooplankton. So my colleagues, the oceanographers and the ecologists, were really interested in understanding the physics, you know, of the ocean and its the connection to the biology in the ocean. So the coupled physics and biology. So the idea was to use these gliders in a group and have them coordinate their motion into patterns that would be well matched to the spatial and temporal dynamics of the oceans. You know, you can give them these kinds of roles and you can provide some guarantees in less dramatically, in settings that have less dramatic currents. But when they get pushed around, there's a priority in these roles. And so we saw them do things like they were supposed to be moving around a sort of a closed circuit, like almost like a rectangular track. And they were supposed to be staying on opposite sides of the track as they moved around so that they would spread out enough and not become redundant, but stay the right distance so that they were getting useful information relative to one another. And there were three pairs of them doing this. But when the current was going really strongly in one direction, one of them would get slowed down because it was facing it. The other one would get sped up because it was moving in the opposite direction. We saw the one that would get sped up kind of extending the rectangle so that it wasted a little time. And the one who was slowed down would kind of cut inside. And that was completely unplanned. This was just sort of emerging from the roles and the setting. And, you know, the robots were desperately trying to keep their distance from one another. It was kind of amazing. And the data set was fantastic.
Whoa. So the robots coordinated their movements together almost accidentally. It sounds like the environment shaped their behavior in a really cool way.
From talking with Ian and Naomi, it seems like a lot of findings in the collective behavior academic universe come up this way, as beautiful accidents.
Definitely. It reminds me of something Ian mentioned.
I was taking a flight back from the US and I suddenly realized, you know, on this long journey when I had plenty of time to think, that maybe there are principles, deep mathematical principles that extend also to neural groups.
Neural groups?
He's talking about interconnected groups of neurons. Each of these brain cells is connected to tens of thousands of other cells, maybe more. So maybe the behavior of these tiny things inside of us can also be thought of as a collective. I'll let Ian explain a little more.
And to ask how neural groups, how the brain makes decisions, might be easier. And so we developed a very sophisticated technology called immersive virtual reality or holographic virtual reality, where we can have animals moving freely, interacting in photorealistic virtual three-dimensional environments, which gives us control over the inputs, the sensory inputs, into the decision-making circuit. And what we discovered here is that there are these fundamental geometrical principles about how the brain takes in complexity in its world and reduces that complexity down to a series of repeated binary decisions that allows the animal to solve very complex problems with a simple algorithm. And that algorithm, the mathematics of how the decision is made, that we discovered in animal groups. Yet we found exactly the same algorithm to be playing the decisive decision-making role in fruit flies, in Drosophila, a model organism, and also in locusts, the swarm-forming animal. And they're widely evolutionary divergent, but they're still both insects. And so we then moved to the zebrafish, to understanding the vertebrate brain. And again, we find that despite these vast differences in their evolutionary past, natural selection, evolution, has found the same solution, because it's a fundamental solution to solve how do you make decisions, whether you're an insect or a vertebrate, whether you're a group of vertebrates deciding between different options.
They basically cracked a universal code here, and we don't even need to know any math to appreciate it. We can just sit back, relax, and bask in the glory of the interconnected cosmos.
I know this is audio, but I kind of look like that galaxy brain GIF right now.
So we're super excited about this, because this is kind of like the holy grail for me, is to realize that, you know, I always thought this idea of collective minds or linking minds together to create this sort of collective intelligence might just be a metaphor. It's fun, but it might not be very deep. But now I'm absolutely convinced that nature has found the same solutions at vastly different scales of organization. So what's going on in the fish's brain within the group is very similar to what's going on at the group level, because the algorithm, the solution, is so beautiful and so capable of solving a vast range of problems. It's a complex scenario, but I hope to have given you at least a little bit of insight into why I think this is so exciting, that we find the same principles, not just similar, the same principles across these huge scales.
It sounds like Ian kind of galaxy brain there too.
Oh, 100%. I asked him if when he saw how beautiful this solution was, he just said, "Are you kidding me?"
I certainly think it's the most important science I've ever done in my career. When I saw this, it blew my mind, because the mathematics behind it was so elegant and so beautiful. Even though I'm not very good at maths myself, I could see the beauty. I could see, oh my God, this is so simple. This is so beautiful. This has to be true. This has to be the way nature works. You know, you just had that instinct. It's too good. It's just so beautiful. These amazing capabilities from these very simple interactions among the neurons. When we actually got those first figures, exactly as you described, I was just, my jaw dropped. I was just, this is it.
Man, that's awesome. That must be such a good feeling.
Absolutely. But of course, he didn't figure it out alone.
And yes, I mean, this is the fun of doing science, isn't it? We're not working in isolation. We have plenty of times where things go wrong. We get papers rejected, where lots of things are negative, and, you know, we're dealing with COVID and isolation. And so when something beautiful like that just turns out to be real, it turns out to actually be the way the real world works, I couldn't stop thinking about it. I just thought, this is just so beautiful. It's so elegant. You know, that makes us feel that we're closer to something fundamental. And it's the starting point. That's the other cool thing, is that this is just the first brushstrokes, in a way, the first sort of instincts towards this problem. There's way more work to do. You've actually reminded me of the joy of doing science. So thanks for that.
Okay, so we've talked a lot about collective behavior in the abstract.
The universal rules governing behavior. Pretty meta stuff.
Exactly. But selfishly, I still kind of want to know what this has to do with me. I mean, my human life.
There are so many interesting questions to ask about human groups. One place to start, what, if anything, is unique about groups of humans relative to groups of non-humans?
I can think of one thing.
What's that?
Well, we have politics, and I mean, I don't think animals do, at least not in the same sense that we do, with elected government officials and Fox News and MAGA hats.
Yeah, that's a thing. So, like many of us, Ian's research group started thinking a lot more about politicized behavior back in 2016.
We were kind of shocked when Trump was elected, and it kind of kicked us into gear into thinking, well, could some of the insights that we have about other types of collectives give us some ways of studying human collectives? That could be insightful. And in particular, we were interested in polarization, how this considerable political polarization that's occurred over the last 50 years in the US, and especially within the last 5 to 10 years. You know, how does that impact collective intelligence? Because we know from understanding animal groups that we need diversity. We need different opinions to play a role, or we erode the benefits of collective intelligence. We also need all individuals to have a say. We need democracy within collectives. And previously, I had done some work on the role of uninformed individuals in animal groups, and how, surprisingly to me, and also, I guess, the community, was that these uninformed individuals, which you sort of think of initially as being a source of noise, were absolutely critical in promoting democracy and promoting democratic consensus decision making.
And these questions inspired them to design a social experiment.
We studied how humans make decisions and how this is influenced by their political view. For example, if I ask you what the state capital of New Jersey is, you know, this shouldn't really be a political decision, but it's a decision one can make. And so we asked lots of people, hundreds of people, different questions that are non-politicized questions. And what we find is that the more confident people are in their opinion, the more accurate they were. And that's very expected, except for the far right. When we looked at very conservatives, they were actually inverted. The more confident they were in their opinions, the less likely they were to be correct. So we created a model of how the brain makes decisions based on our data, to then use that model to make predictions of what, you know, if humans are behaving like this in relation to their political views, what we would expect to occur on networks like Twitter and Facebook. And so what we find is that, you know, polarization is extremely detrimental to good collective decision making. And in particular, when you have the extremists within this network, even though there's a small subset of them, they will tend to pull down the accuracy, the ability of the whole network to make good decisions.
Humans screaming about politics on Twitter should be a separate model organism, to be honest.
Right? That came up in our conversation too. I was kind of joking, but I asked, what's the deal with Twitter anyway? Like, schools of fish are not coordinating via trending hashtags, as far as I'm aware. So how does the fact that we can communicate with each other virtually shake things up, collective behavior-wise?
We, like the animals, have evolved to have these relatively close-range communication abilities. Of course, we humans have evolved things like writing and song and cultural transmission, you know, via art and telling stories and so on. So we've already evolved to take information across distances, either in time or in space, you know, that are quite considerable. You know, if you write something, you can distribute that written work. But, you know, our fundamental evolutionary states, you know, things were very, very local. And it's only extremely recently, you know, in the advent of first of the telephone and then, you know, of the internet, that, you know, these ranges, these also the jet plane and so on, you know, being able to transport ourselves as well very quickly, has completely changed that. It's completely changed the scale at which we can communicate and the speed at which we can communicate. And we haven't evolved to deal with that very well. We haven't evolved to deal with that at all.
That makes sense. I mean, fish don't have to, like, keep track of Twitter drama.
And so much of the drama is fake news. Misinformation has been such a hot-button issue lately between the election and the pandemic, so I asked Ian to tell us some more.
We all think of this ability to almost instantaneously communicate with a very large number of people as a good thing, but our work and others suggest that that's not necessarily the case. You know, there's a real trade-off between speed and accuracy of decisions. What we think is good is, like, fast global communication is actually terrible for decision making because it can cause these amplifications of misinformation. We know from other people's research that, you know, false information spreads much faster and much further in social networks than does true information. I mean, there's a phrase that's been misattributed to Mark Twain: fake news is halfway around the world while the truth is, you know, putting on its shoes. And that's, you know, not from him, but it's true. You know, quantitatively, we know this, and it's because false information is surprising. Surprising information rewards our brain, and we propagate this information. And if we have a temptation and a tendency to spread misinformation more quickly and more enthusiastically, perhaps, than true information, then this, you know, maybe within our small hunter-gatherer-type societies from which we evolved, this can compensate itself. This can, you know, slowly spread through, but then be compensated for by the true information which comes afterwards. Whereas now the sort of inoculation by true information takes so long that false information can spread and be stuck. I mean, we find this today in Germany, where I am living now.
Quick note, today was actually the first week of March when we originally recorded this interview. But, you know, corona time moves in mysterious ways.
The AstraZeneca vaccine, which had some misinformation about its efficacy and its safety, is now not being taken up by people because it's perceived, just colloquially perceived by word of mouth, by non-scientists, by the community, as being less good than Pfizer and BioNTech and Moderna. These things matter, how things are communicated to people. We expect if you give people false information, if it gets propagated, you know, by one or two newspapers, then it can spread as if it's true, because people don't have the time or the knowledge to go back and really assess whether it's true. And by then it can be too late to reverse the situation. And so it's really, really important to understand collective behavior and how we influence each other and what we can do to help ourselves make better collective decisions, because, you know, it can really matter regarding COVID as one example, but also climate change and other sort of global phenomena that we need to solve as a collective.
Interestingly, misinformation might be stickier for certain groups of people than others.
When we did our studies, for example, of political views in human groups, we found that the very conservative people did not tend to use social information unless it agreed with what they already believed. Everyone else did, even conservatives did, but very conservatives did not. Now, if you only believe what you already believe, well, there's no benefit to pooling information with others or obtaining social information. And so that makes for groups, frankly, to be stupid. So we have to find ways to minimize the considerable problems that come with broadcasting potentially false information to large numbers of people, and for people to have this bias to just believe what they already believe, because both of these properties erode our ability as a society and a community to make good group decisions.
Wait, so what are we supposed to do then? I mean, I know that I tend to believe things that align with my existing views totally subconsciously.
Oh, 100% same. It's human nature.
Right. But I mean, is there something that we can do to minimize these issues? Should we just deactivate all our Twitter accounts and flush our phones down the toilet?
And I'm a huge fan of technology and I utilize technology. So I'm not suggesting that we return to some sort of Luddite kind of, you know, let's throw out all of this technology. But we do have to appreciate our own limitations and how this has completely changed our whole society's ability and means to communicate that can both be for tremendous good, for sure, but also has that tremendous risk as well.
Not all social study of collective behavior is that heavy duty, though. Ever had that moment when you almost collide with someone walking past you and you move to the side and they move the same way and then you're just like, ah! So Naomi studies that.
You know, we're looking at that newly, recently, problems of like, you know, walking down a corridor and passing somebody or a group of people passing one another and trying to understand how people would move together and then how people would handle, you know, even moving around an obstacle, but you know, moving around a person and how to unpack the dance that we do when you sometimes both move the same direction and you can't get by somebody.
There are actually some adorable videos of these experiments called Multi-Robot Navigation Agreement, which we've linked in the episode transcript, so check that out. You have these little wheeled robots that start off sitting in a circle, they're a couple of feet apart from one another, and then they all start wheeling in the same direction.
Like when you stand up at the end of a meeting and all start pushing towards the exit.
Yeah, pretty much. And they all do this little like, thing that we do, you know, when we meet someone else in the hallway and don't know which way to go, you know, at least for a quick second. And then their movements start to straighten out and they get out of each other's way.
Well, once she figures out how this awkward walking dance works, I hope that she tells me all of her secrets and how to avoid it at all costs.
Me too. It sounds like studying collective behavior is really important if we want to understand how to solve the big global problems we're facing today.
Exactly. COVID, climate change, research shortages, all of these massive challenges will require lots of teamwork to overcome.
These researchers probably know better than anyone What's the secret? How do we make good decisions as a collective? I mean, my friends and I can barely agree on what to order from DoorDash without killing each other.
Same. Luckily, Ian did have a few hot tips for us.
I guess if I've got sort of four secrets to making smart decisions in the face of all of these complexities that I talked about, the first would be to allow diverse opinions to be expressed. We humans are terrible at listening to others that have different viewpoints to ourselves. And the polarization we see in society is the worst possible thing for allowing humans to talk. And one of the areas there that's important is to allow people with weak opinions or no opinions to participate in decision-making. These uninformed individuals play a very important role, acting as a social glue and acting for information to flow between others that wouldn't necessarily otherwise see eye to eye.
So, lesson number one, include and promote diverse opinions. And lesson number two,
egalitarian communication, turn-taking communication, is critical for making good collective decisions. It does not matter who the smartest person in the group is or whether their IQ is high. It doesn't matter much how the average IQ of a group is. What matters is how the group communicates. Groups that communicate well perform extremely well across the board. So turn-taking is essential.
Right, number two, take turns, give everyone a chance to speak.
Lesson number three relates to that. If you want a shortcut to have high collective intelligence, the more women in a group, the better. And that's not some political statement, that's an objective fact. Because women allow turn-taking to occur. And so if you can encourage men to have turn-taking and not have this sort of alpha male attitude, then they can also perform really highly. But they tend to be more competitive and more kind of, you know, individuals seeking dominance in groups. That's a terrible thing that we've perpetuated in society that is disastrous for collective decision-making.
Number three, have more women.
Well, we could have told you that.
Obviously. Okay, last but not least.
Bigger is not always better. In fact, it's not often better. Big groups do not make better decisions. And I mean, there's a lot of reasons why, but it tends to be groups of less than 12 individuals that tend to make good decisions. And so you could potentially make good decisions by having groups of groups to maximize collective intelligence.
Naomi agreed.
I think it's just this again and again, just realizing how unbelievable it is that these animal groups, and often it's the individual can't do anything nearly as well as the group, but the group is like this super unit that is so spectacular and seems to tackle problems that we can't do as humans.
That might seem like a lofty statement, especially given that the model organisms that Ian and Naomi study are things like fish, animals we normally don't think of as ever making up a super unit. But as Naomi will tell you, doing this kind of research teaches you surprising things.
It's interesting because Ian will tell you that, you know, you look at these fish and they look so similar. And yet he'll tell you that absolutely they have personalities. There are some that are bold, some that are shy. They may be related to their next door neighbor. They may be not related to their next door neighbor. They may be Machiavellian in their strategies. They may be, you know, very docile. They may be older and experienced. They may be younger. They may be sated. They may be hungry. You know, they could differ in, you know, some could swim faster, some could swim slower. So they could differ in their characteristics. They could differ in their state, right? Whether they just ate. They could differ in their age and knowledge. They could differ about, you know, merely where they are in the school, if they're on the periphery, versus whether they're in the center. And so, yeah, I think this is a sort of a fascinating direction. And it relates to all the sort of the wonderful things that we've learned about the role of diversity in groups of people.
And the study of collective behavior would not be possible without diversity and collaboration between groups of collective behavior researchers.
I have to say that I think that the stories that I tell are perhaps not even my own, but they're what I learned from the scientists who, you know, who brought me in so graciously to use my tools to see if I can, you know, help answer their questions. But I think one of the reasons that I've enjoyed it so much is that I become so fascinated with the questions that they ask. It's not just that I want to push my tools on people. It's that I'm just sort of blown away.
From bird flocks to dancers, from schools of fish to ocean-going robots, we live in an intensely social world, whether by nature or by design. Creatures like ants and bees live in communities of hundreds to thousands of individuals, and they seem to communicate in their own secret language. And while it's true that we'll probably never decipher their little bug languages, the nitty-gritty nuances of their antenna waggles and whatever, that doesn't necessarily mean that we can't hear what they have to say.
And it's all the more amazing because while these individuals are so small, their emergent behaviors are large and beautiful and totally mind-bending. There's so much that they can teach us.
All right, it's settled. Size doesn't matter.
Oy. Yeah. This episode was produced by Deanna Nekula and me, Celia Ford, with help from the rest of the team at Carry the One Radio. Thank you so much to Ian Cousin and Naomi Leonard for their time, and to you for listening. This episode wouldn't have been possible without the enormously generous support of our Patreon supporters, so I'd like to thank this episode's science producers and beautiful patrons, Sama Ahmed, Carly Van Orstel, Janine Cuevas, Samantha Anconda Esselman, and David Cabral. If you want to join the club, head over to patreon.com/carrytheone. Your financial support helps us to keep the show running, and we're grateful for anything you're able to give. There's also a free way to support us that means a lot. You can share our podcast with everyone you know, rate us, and leave glowing reviews. You can find us on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and wherever you get your podcasts. With that, have a beautiful day and stay curious.